That's a marvelous way of taking the wind out of their sails.
That one. But it didn't die there. I mean, that's a bad weather. It didn't finish there because then the journalists try to get involved in it and so forth. And then we finally settled the thing out of court. But isn't this what resulted in your setting up a public relations department? Did that happen around this time? That and some other things too, because we did not have a public relations department. We had one or two guys working on it, and they were not skilled in it. And I'm not sure that we ever had anybody that's too skilled in it. But yes, that happened about that time, in the late 1970s, early 80s, and we expanded it. Another thing you did, so you've had. You really had a baptism of fire in these early years with all of these incidents. And then, so you're trying to reorganize the company, you're worrying about fibers, you're worrying about these environmental problems. And then you also adopted the matrix management system at the same time.
That's right.
About 75 or so, something.
That's right.
Yeah. Which, I don't know, was that much of a shock to the company, the management?
No, because we took a year studying it, and not just paper studies in which we would get groups of managers from and people from different parts of the company together and talk, and then we had a 6 or 7 day, about a 3 day seminar where we hammered the thing out. No, that was well received.
Okay.
Well received. Some of the consultants said, no, don't do that, but they weren't always right either. Actually, for the time, it worked pretty well for us at the time.
I don't know, is it still in a place, or is it? You kept it at least longer than other companies who tried it and got out.
Yeah, we have a version of it. Now, I guess it's so hard to tell what's matrix and what isn't, because it's management by teams these days. So that's about what we moved into in the early 1980s. Would be a team approach to management, which isn't very far from the matrix that we had before. Now, I guess it had, even before I retired, it had moved one step where it wasn't so much a matrix as the business people being in charge, even of manufacturing. Whereas before you'd have a manufacturer right here, but now a business person is in charge of the whole thing.
'78, and there was, well, first of all, in '78 there were some administrative changes.
That's when I
became, you went up to chairman,
right?
But stayed as CEO at the
right,
same time.
Yes. The reason for that is that I felt we had grown to the point where we needed a chief operating officer, and frankly, Otto, the first 5 years I was CEO, present CEO, he was chairman. It was in name only. I conducted the meetings, the board meetings. He did really nothing, and then he said, "Well, it's only fair. My brother John should have a crack at this." So we made John chairman for 2 or 3 years, and then I said to myself we need a CEO, a COO, chief operating officer, and with the right title. It should be president, COO, and the CEO should be the chairman of the board. And I'd seen that I'd come to that conclusion independently of Roman Haas. So there was no resistance. John Haas didn't give a damn. He doesn't care about titles, and so I don't know what we made him vice chairman, or maybe we even retired the title of vice chairman. But I became chairman, CEO, and then we made Don Feli president, COO. So that was not a big deal throughout the company.
This was when you adopted, 78, I think, is when you adopted what came known as Rona.
Right.
What was the origin? Was that your idea? Was that
absolutely.
Your
well, at 78, it was came into full flower. Really, we really started a little bit earlier. The
if you think about sort of management policies and strategies, in the 1970 up through the 74-75 period of time, we were heavily influenced by the Boston Consulting Group's market growth, market share, grow your share, and if you grow your share in the right products, costs will come down, and all of that. And we really went out and grew a lot of things, and the had damn good results until the oil shock hit us, and then that that hurt, and the fibers came at the same time. So we came to the I came to the conclusion, and so did some others, that you know, market share isn't enough. There's got to be return on investment, and we've got to have our people involved in this business so that they're operating like they're their own businesses, so they're not just spending company money and so forth. So that's when we adopted RONA, and it was much more than just a formula for return on net assets. It was a philosophy of doing business. Look at it as if your own, and you're going to be judged by your returns. If you think you want to put your own money into it, well, then make a proposition for it. If you don't want to put your own in it, don't do it. And this had very dramatic results over a period of 2 or 3 years for us, where we went from down here in the lower quartile in terms of productivity and return on investment, no matter how you want to measure it, until we moved right up to the top. And in the early 80s, we got up there, and I know the last 5 or 6 years, we were number one, according to Forbes or whoever, in return on net assets amongst the chemical companies. So it worked. If I could just finish off, there are three periods. That first one from 70 to about 75, 76, when the emphasis was on the BCG approach, market share, market growth. And then 76 through about 82 or 83, where the emphasis was on RONA, and we really improved our productivity and our returns, profitability, however you want to measure it. And then we began to be worried about the Japanese and what they'd done to the automobile companies, and decided and got Deming in and TQL decided, hell, we've got to get the people involved. So that's when we shifted slightly, but we did shift with an emphasis on teamwork and doing it by teams rather than the RONA thing, which was tended to be more come from the top down and can be very autocratic. It would depend on the personality of the people that are running it, but it could be autocratic. So that's when we moved into the same mode that the company is still in, which is total quality leadership. That's part of it, and the customer, and work with the customer. And we're just way out in that now. We have our computers in the customer's place, and P&G, we run their inventories for them. We ship whatever they needed, and they never even see anything except a bill. And I guess they don't even see that. That probably goes through a computer, is paid by a computer. But that was we moved from RONA to that. But we never gave up on RONA though, because we felt that it was a good discipline.
How did you come up with that? What was the impetus behind that?
I don't remember. All I remember is that growing your sales is not good enough, and that there's something about this BCG philosophy that doesn't ring true, and we've got to get the other half of the fraction in there, which is the investment.
Okay.
And it hit you between the eyes when you see a couple things growing like hell in sales and losing your shirt and your cash flow.
I have a quote here that I think it came from the last Roman House history. While seeking to contain costs, yet the company increased its spending for new product research. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. In an attempt to stay ahead of its competition. Significant research efforts also were dedicated to improving current processes and developing new ones for the manufacture of established products. And that led to a number of things, one of which was Vacor, Blazer. There are others that grew out of this philosophy. So while you're implementing these financial programs, the emphasis still on R&D.
That's right. And you mentioned two that are no longer with us. Blazer was a success. We finally sold it, and that was patent problems more than anything else that caused it to sell it. Baycor was the rat killer. That was unbelievable. That damn thing killed rats and human beings, and that's all. We tested it on everything. We tested on when we got the hint from Korea that there was a problem, and we tested on dogs. We tested on baboons, monkeys. Didn't hurt them. Killed the rats, and it killed people. So that was a bad one. But
that's all part of this problem of determining what. And I want to get later on, if we have time, to the CIIT involvement activity that you've had. Because how do you make that extrapolation from animals to humans?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Baycor thing was unfortunate, too, in another way, because the government of Korea would not permit us to do the tests over there that we wanted to. They were just being eaten up by rats. I mean, their food and children and everything. Decon was no longer effective, so they didn't have anything that was effective except the really deadly poisons, and the people were dying from those. So they insisted that they were going to do the testing. Now, we should have stopped that, but they did the testing. And there were half a dozen children died because they ate the thing. So that's when we did our own testing and could not establish that it was non-toxic to humans. But that was a tough thing to do because I had a guy over there in Korea, and he called me, and he said, this general here down in Pusan Peninsula, who I'm right with him, he says that there's no use trying to exhume these bodies and see whether these people really died from Baycor or something else, because he's got two North Koreans in jail out here, and he said if he can feed them those, he said it doesn't make any difference because he's going to shoot the sons of bitches next week anyway. And I said, Hale, I said, God damn it, I said, you, and I knew that this between here and Korea was monitored, the CIA was monitoring. I said, you get the hell out of there, bring the whole team and get the hell home here right away. That's the end of it. So, there were a lot of, you mentioned a couple, Blazer was a success, a resounding success, but unfortunately the patent thing was hit us between the eyes, and I still don't think that was right, but that was the decision of the powers that be, the lawyers and the courts. But but there are a lot of other products came out of that surge in research that we started at that time, which had been very valuable to this company. And that's where the people at research are very happy about what we did then.
But at the same time, then, you started reassessing the product lines. This is under the Rona influence. So that you decided certain things. You were going to concentrate in polymers and ag. That seemed to be the thrust that you wanted to focus on.
Well, it wasn't necessarily polymers and ag. We were getting out of fibers, and I don't know whether we'd get out of health products by that time or not. But what we did was, we looked at the thing, and what's the Rona? That was the measuring stick, universal. What's the Rona? And what's the realistic Rona if it's done differently and it grows in the future? And so that was what came out of it, and that's improved our efficiency. We did clean out the product line. I don't polymers, ag, plastics. We didn't get out of plastics. We had and still have a lot of plastics in there. But polymers, of course, covers an awful lot of sins.
So you sold things, and then you acquired others. And
yeah.
I think the one that the PVC business from BorgWarner was
one
of the...
That's a real winner. Yeah.
And that was a case where you could pick up the technology a lot less than you could develop it on your own.
Yeah, there were two technologies for this type of modifier, the one we had and the one Borg Warner had. And they sold theirs to this Japanese outfit that had it in Grangemouth, and they didn't know how to run the plant. They were losing their shirt, so we got a good buy on that. And with this buy, we had the two major technologies, and we had a big market share. We never say dominant anymore. But we had by far the largest market share worldwide with these two. That was a winner. And another one we bought about that time was somewhere in there was the ion exchange business from Diamond Shamrock. Okay. And that was a good one. So we were shifting around in addition to manufacturing our own. Researching and inventing our own.
Another quote, I think, from the last Romanov's history. Under Gregory, the values and philosophies were those of the founder. Direct dealings with the customer, strong emphasis on research, and concern for the employees.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's part of this move back away from Rona, in which we had teamwork and individuals, and we started out by emphasizing values. And I never forget when I announced this to the board of directors, this is what we're going to do. I said, this is what we plan to do. And we were down one of these islands, Hilton Head or somewhere, where I announced that this guy from IBM, Spike Beitzel, had just been elected to the board. And he said, God, he said, I think that's wonderful. He said, because we do that at IBM. He said, but I never saw anybody ask the board for advice in one of these things until they got the thing established. But we did. And it did make sense, and it really rang true, and it still does. It still does.
In the early 80s, Romanhaus was spending 4% of sales on R&D, which was about twice the norm of the industry. And you talked about something called phased innovation. I think the idea was always have something new coming out of your R&D and becoming another product line. So it was one matures, you have another one in the pipeline.
I don't know what I meant by phased innovation, but you know, you can't schedule invention. So I don't know what I meant there. Where'd you get that one from? From the history?
No, it's not. This is from some article someplace.
Yeah. I must have meant something else, because I never believed that you could schedule invention.
Well, because that comes up to something else I have a quote from you. But at the time, this was 83, Blazer was in the new business area. You were looking into bringing in along electronic chemicals. You had hybrid crops coming up, so that I think ideally you would like to always have something new in the pipeline.
In the business portfolio. Maybe talking from a portfolio standpoint, that would make sense. I mean, you're always strengthening the portfolio. I mean, taking out the weak cats and putting in some new ones, and in that case, phasing them in would make sense. But it wouldn't make sense as far as research is concerned.
Well, this comes then to the next quote, which is, what we can't plan is when someone is going to make a pioneering discovery.
That's right.
When that hits, it is going to take money, so we have to have some flexibility. We don't want to spend all our cash and then not have anything when a major breakthrough comes.
Yeah.
And I guess that's, from other places that people I've talked to, the emphasis in R&D in this company has been quite different, it seems, over the long haul. Others have had some real ups and downs.
Yeah.
But it seems to have been pretty steady here.
Yeah, I'll say. Well, your 4% of sales surprised me. I thought we were higher than that, but I think my target was higher. We never wasn't able to spend it, but we can get that number.
Well, what I'd like to do now, and this will lead us into that question, what we haven't covered on that question list, but you wrote in a paper called The Chief Executive's Role in R&D. And I'd just like to sort of go down some of the points you've raised in there. And
so when did I write that?
Well, that was... I should have a copy here. I think the date's on the bottom.
Summer of 1985.
But in there you comment, as we just said before, that it's difficult to measure productivity of research.
Right.
You can't quantify it as such. And I guess every CEO would hope that as one product gets to maturity, the research people will come up with a new one, too. Recently I talked to someone who was involved with a major breakthrough for a company and as the researcher, and they wouldn't let him be involved in development because they wanted to go back to the lab and make another one. And those usually come once in a lifetime after that. But in that article, you raised a number of points in terms of what the CEO's responsibility was towards the research, and I'd just like to mention them and see if...
Yeah, go ahead. I don't ever remember writing this damn thing, but who did I write this for? Directors and Boards, Technology.
Oh, it's taken from a... There's a footnote at the end. It's taken at the very end. It's taken from something else.
Originally appearing in Research Management. Yeah.
The first of those points that you made was, in terms of the CEO's responsibility, is that you have to get world-class players.
Not for sure.
How do you do that? How do you know who's a world-class player?
Well, first of all, I think you look at the... you start with the universities. I mean, if you're starting with hiring people... Unless you're hiring someone with a track record, and then you know. But we didn't do much of that until I finally hired a chief. You go to the best universities, and then you interview, and you have your smartest people interview them that are good at it, and you do the best you can. You got to be prepared to pay too. That's part of it as well. And I think that there's something, there's always been a little bit of conflict here about, and that was that I said, you know, for even PhDs, especially PhDs, let's have a 2-year, 3-year time frame, if they're not going to make it, and unless they're sort of promoted out of that introductory level at the end of two or 3 years, if they're not promoted, let's sit down and take a real serious look and say, you're probably better off to go somewhere else. That way to keep up.
Mm-hmm. In keeping with that, although I'm skipping on this list, another point was that there had to be a career development for research-oriented people. So if you've got somebody who wants to stay in research, who's good at it, that you keep them there, but you have a reward system in place at the same time.
Yep.
For a long time, the researchers were stuck. They could go just a little bit, and they would spend the rest of their life at that point. Whereas if they went over to the management ladder, they had a lot more in terms of opportunities. How did you feel? I mean, it's really quite a responsibility, because here you are, you're still quite young compared to everyone else, and all of a sudden, for the first time in the company's history, there's nobody in the family.